This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Justice Lost by Scott Pratt, performed by James Patrick Cronin. At his best, man is the noblest of all animals. Separated from law and justice, he is the worst. Aristotle. Part 1. Chapter 1. I looked around at the circle of empty chairs. There were two empty seats to my right and two to my left. I was back at Farragut High School outside Knoxville, Tennessee, in the classroom assigned for in-school detention. I'd been there several times in my youth for fighting, but this seemed more serious. The doors were made of iron bars, the walls were concrete block and painted Old Glory blue, the same color as that on the American flag. Hovering over me at the front of the class was Mrs. Judge, a woman I'd dealt with before. Her appearance had changed dramatically, though, since I'd last seen her. Her face was as gray as bone ash, and she was staring at me through tinted glasses that were as thick as the bottoms of old beer bottles and looked almost like goggles. She was wearing a red silk robe with a white lace collar. In her right hand, she held a set of pan mechanical balance scales, and in her left, she carried a double-edged sword that looked, from where I was sitting, to be razor sharp. When she'd come into the room a few seconds earlier, she hadn't walked like a normal human. She'd floated across the floor like a ghost. I was trembling. There wasn't much in the world that I feared, but this version of Mrs. Judge terrified me. She seemed to radiate power and danger, and I couldn't escape the feeling that she could incinerate me with one blazing look from her eyes. And if she was quick with the sword, which I was certain she was, my head could be rolling across the floor at any second.
"Where are your friends, Mr. Street?" Mrs. Judge said in a slow, gravelly southern accent.
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said. She raised her hands, the sword and scales gleaming, and fire began to swirl around my head.
"Don't lie to me, Mr. Street. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Where are your four friends who are supposed to be sitting in these four seats?"
"They're not my friends," I said. I looked up at her hideous face and then back down at the floor.
"Do you dare trifle with me? I have no qualms about turning you to dust and blowing you to the far edges of the universe. You will speak the truth in this room."
"I had to do something," I said.
"You mean you had to take justice into your own hands. You had to become a vigilante."
"Call it whatever you want. I'd do it again."
"I want to hear you say it," she said. "I want you to look at me and tell me exactly what you did."
I forced myself to look at the face. It was the face of a person, no, an entity, that had been twisted and betrayed and misunderstood and beaten and defeated, yet stood defiantly and continued to fight. "There is no such thing as justice, you know," I said. "There are only random acts followed by revenge."
"Tell me what you did."
Her voice was so forceful it nearly shattered my eardrums.
"Confess right now. What did you do to the four men who should be sitting in these chairs?"
"I killed them," I said. "All four of them. Are you happy? I shot Donnie Frazier and Tommy Bean in a bar in West Virginia. I blew them to hell. They didn't have a chance. I helped hang the former federal prosecutor, Ben Clancy, in a barn up by Gatlinburg, and then I fed his sorry ass to a pen full of hungry pigs. And Big Pappy Donovan? He wanted to kill me. He actually wanted to have an old-fashioned duel in the mountains near Petros. He was crazy. He'd gone completely off the rails. So I met him, and we had our duel. He lost, and then he wound up in the same pig pen as Ben Clancy."
"And you got away with all four of the killings,"
she said. You face no consequences from the laws of man.
I got away with the killings.
Do you feel no remorse for the taking of human lives?
None. Fraser and Bean murdered my mother. Clancy falsely convicted me of murder and sent me off to prison for 2 years. Big Pappy was a sociopath, if not a psychopath, who wanted to kill me. It was him or me.
What makes you think you get to make these choices? She said. What makes you think you have the power to decide who lives and who dies?
Mrs. Judge was judging me, and I wasn't having it. I didn't know whether or not I was dreaming, but what I was feeling was very real to me. My fear was suddenly replaced by anger, and I gave no thought to what might happen to me for confronting this powerful force. What makes you think you have that same power? I said. You're nothing but the product of the wealthy protecting themselves from the poor. You're a hypocrite and a false idol, and as far as I'm concerned, you can take your hypocrisy and go straight to hell. I felt the air go out of the room and heard the metallic whoosh of her sword being raised into the air.
Get on your knees, Mrs. Judge said.
I looked up at her and stood. I don't hit my knees for you or anybody else, I said. If you're going to take my head, you're going to do it while I'm standing.
Her smile revealed pointed, yellowed teeth. Have it your way, she said, and the sword dove toward me at the speed of...
I felt the hand on my shoulder, and my eyes immediately popped open. I looked around the den, heard the television, and couldn't believe I'd dozed off. Is it time? I said.
Are you all right, Darren? You sounded like you were having a nightmare.
I'm fine. I was dreaming about this teacher I had in high school named Mrs. Judge. It was strange. What about you? How are the contractions?
I think we should go, Grace said. They're about 60 seconds, and they're coming every 3 or 4 minutes.
Do they hurt?
Ever had somebody push on your lower abdomen with an anvil? She said.
Can't say that I have.
That's what they feel like. The longer they get, the heavier the anvil.
Grace's contractions had begun the day before, but they'd been intermittent. Over the past several hours, however, they'd become more intense and had come at much shorter intervals. I looked at the clock next to the couch. It was 7:45 p.m. on Friday night. We were both dressed and had everything packed in my car. Grace called her mother and father, both of whom lived in San Diego, California, and told them we were heading to the hospital. The thought struck me that it was rather pitiful that I didn't have anyone to call. My son, Sean, who was 9 years old, had just returned to Hawaii after having spent the summer with Grace and me. He knew Grace was going to have a baby and seemed excited by the fact that he was going to have a sister. But I knew if I tried to call him, his mother, Katie, would ignore the call, so I just let it go. Grace took my arm, and we walked out of the building into the mid-August heat and humidity. 20 minutes later, we arrived at the birthing center just south of Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything was prearranged. Grace had been the perfect mother-to-be. She'd taken good care of herself, gotten plenty of exercise and rest, and eaten well, with the exception of an unusually large intake of French fries that she chalked up to cravings. She'd worked her job at the Federal Defender's Office until the previous week, and was planning to take a month off after our baby girl, her name was to be Jasmine Kathleen Alexander, was born. Grace had chosen the name, and I liked it. Since she and I weren't married and had no immediate plans in that vein, we'd agreed the child would take Grace's last name. If we decided to take the vows at some point, we'd talk about names then. What we called the child didn't really mean that much to me. All I wanted was a healthy, happy baby girl, and I planned to love her with everything I could muster. A nurse told me to take a seat in a small waiting room, and she'd come to get me when Grace was settled into her birthing suite. I sat down and began to reflect. Grace and I were getting along well. She'd kicked me out of her apartment when she suspected I'd been involved in killing the 2 men who'd murdered my mother, but her stance had eventually softened. I'd finally opened up and been honest with her about what had happened to Ben Clancy and Big Pappy, and she had allowed me back into her life,
with the stipulation that I see a psychiatrist on a weekly basis, both to overcome post-traumatic stress disorder from my time in prison, and to try to make sense of the violence that had been visited upon me and my reactions to that violence. Eventually, Grace became akin to a wife whose husband had volunteered for a combat tour overseas and had taken lives and seen terrible things in the line of duty. She didn't really understand the things I'd done, but on some level, she accepted that, in my way of thinking, I'd really had no choice. I had to avenge my mother by killing the men who had killed her. I had to force justice upon Ben Clancy because the system that was in place wasn't going to do a thing to him. And I had to protect myself from Big Pappy Donovan because he was a dangerous killer. I'd been a criminal defense lawyer for more than a decade and knew the judicial system inside and out. It had failed me again and again, so I'd taken matters into my own hands and used my knowledge of the laws of evidence and the individual protections afforded by the Constitution not only to dole out my own brand of justice, but also to do so in such a manner that the police and the lawyers and the judges never got a chance to hold me accountable. Grace still looked at me strangely sometimes, but I believed she had forgiven me. I'd visited a shrink for months, never mentioning any of the murders I'd committed, before Grace allowed me to stop. It was good she let me stop when she did, because the doctor was beginning to annoy me so much that I'd begun to fantasize about strangling her and hauling her up to Granny Tipton's pig pen. Grace hadn't renewed the lease on her apartment when it came time 2 months earlier, and had moved in with me. I had an extra bedroom, and she slept in there. There was no sex, but we'd become closer than ever during those 2 months. I found myself doting on her, which she enjoyed. I was a perfect gentleman, holding doors and holding hands and saying please and thank you. I felt the baby moving in Grace's womb, listened to her heartbeat. I also listened intently to everything Grace said, and if she asked me a question, I gave her a thoughtful and honest answer. I hadn't said I love you to her since before she kicked me out of her apartment, but it was the first thing I planned to say as soon as the baby was born. I thought it would be a good start to our lives together as parents. I didn't know how she'd react, but I was going to say it anyway. Like I said, I still sensed just a bit of distrust from her. I knew she wanted me in Jasmine's life, but I wasn't sure at this point whether she'd totally committed to our relationship as husband and wife. Grace cared for me, and she let me know it, but I sensed that she also regarded me warily sometimes, the way a trainer of dangerous lions regards the animals. I wondered occasionally whether she stayed with me out of an old-fashioned sense of duty. She'd made the choice to sleep with me, she'd become pregnant, and now it was her duty to stay with me and to attempt to successfully hold the family together. Maybe she didn't want to disappoint her parents. I barely knew them, but from what Grace had told me, they were conservative and old school. Her father was a career Marine Corps officer, and her mother was a journalism professor. Maybe Grace didn't want them to have the stigma of a bastard grandchild, so she stuck with me in the hope that I would be able to resist some of my behavioral and emotional urges, and we'd eventually marry. A nursing assistant opened the door of the birthing suite and motioned me to come in. I settled in on the couch while a nurse attached leads to Grace so they could monitor her and the baby's vital signs. The nurse attaching the leads was pretty, maybe 35, with black hair and dark brown eyes. She'd written Jenny Diaz on a board that hung on the wall near the bed. "Who's on call?" Grace said to Jenny. "Dr. Fatura?" Grace crinkled her nose. "Is that a problem?" I said.
"It's fine. I've seen him twice at the office. He just seemed a little distracted."
I expected a comforting phrase from the nurse, something like, "Oh, Dr. Fatura is excellent. You're in good hands." But none was forthcoming. She just continued to adjust the monitors. "What do you think of Dr. Fatura, Jenny?" I said.
"I've been a labor and delivery nurse for 10 years, but my husband and I just moved to Knoxville," she said. "I've only been here 6 weeks, so I'm not very familiar with the doctors yet. I've already paged him, though. He should be here soon.
He isn't in the building? I said. We called before we left the apartment and were told he'd be here.
He must just be running a little late. Nothing to worry about. We still have a little while. She's dilated 6 centimeters.
The door opened and a thin, dark-haired, mid-30s man with a receding hairline walked in.
Ah, here's the magic man, Jenny said.
I'm Dr. Sams, the man said, nodding to both Grace and me. I'm the anesthesiologist, and I'm here to administer your epidural.
Thank God, Grace said.
They asked me to leave the room again, and 10 minutes later, Dr. Sams walked through the door. You can go back, he said. I'll check on her regularly. I found a different woman when I returned, one whose face was no longer pale and drawn. She looked relaxed, almost angelic.
Anesthesia is the bomb, Grace said. It was like he walked in here and sprinkled fairy dust all over me.
Chapter 2. In a trendy bar near Turkey Creek on Knoxville's west side, Dr. Nicholas Frattura raised a glass of 15-year-old bourbon in a toast to the blonde sitting on the bar stool next to him. His pager vibrated against his side again, but he ignored it.
To your good health, your beautiful face, your gorgeous body, and my prospects of getting you out of that very sexy dress in the near future, he said beneath the din of young professionals who crowded the bar every Friday night. The blonde, a financial analyst from Nashville named Danielle Davis, was at least 10 years younger than Frattura, raised her eyebrows.
Don't believe in wasting time, do you, doctor?
That's something I learned early on as a doctor, Frattura said. Life is short, and it is precious. There is absolutely no sense in wasting time.
There is such a thing as decorum, though, don't you think?
Davis said as she clinked her glass of Chardonnay against his bourbon.
You said you were here to close a deal with one of your firm's biggest clients, Frattura said, ignoring the question. Where's your client?
We're close to getting it done, she said. But it's his 30th wedding anniversary. I'll have to wait until Monday.
How lucky for me, Frattura said. Forgive my lack of decorum, but my experience has been that some women find straight talk sexy. The way I see it, one of two things is going to happen. Either the two of us are going to spend the weekend together in luxurious and amorous bliss, or we aren't. I would prefer that we do. You can stay at my house if you'd like. I'm single. Or you can stay at your hotel and we can maintain a little space if you're more comfortable doing so. Everything will be on me. Food, drink, mood-altering substances, if you're into that sort of thing. I have a 5,000-square-foot home overlooking the Tennessee River, an incredible pool, absolute privacy, and an insatiable sexual appetite. All you have to do is say yes, and we're out of this place.
The beeper vibrated again, and Frattura became irritated. He pulled it from his belt and looked down.
What kind of medicine do you practice? Davis said.
OBGYN.
Why doesn't that surprise me? The look on your face says something is wrong. Is there an emergency? Someone having a baby?
No, no, nothing wrong, no emergency. I'm not even on call this weekend. I just need to take care of something. Will you excuse me for a few minutes?
Of course.
Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Frattura made his way out of the crowded bar and into the men's room. He would have gone outside, but a severe thunderstorm had suddenly blown into Knoxville, and rain was falling in sheets. He dialed a number on his cell.
Bernie? Yeah, yeah, I need a favor. I'm on call tonight. A patient has come in, and I can't make it. Can you cover for me?
Frattura listened to the answer, something about a daughter's volleyball game. He stepped into a stall and lowered his voice.
Come on, Bernie, I've done you plenty of favors in the past, he said.
Really? Was the response from Bernie Weinstein, a member of Frattura's medical group. Name one. Frattura cringed.
Give me a break, Bernie, this is important.
Where are you? Weinstein asked.
Your speech is slurred. You're drinking again, aren't you, Nick?
No, I'm past all that. I just need you to cover for me.
You're lying. You're drunk. Which bar are you in, and I'll call Bill Taylor. Have him come and pick you up. Taylor won't say anything to anyone.
I'm not in a fucking bar. My mother fell and broke her hip. I'm driving to Murfreesboro.
And this fall happened when?
I don't know. A couple of hours ago, I think. I just found out.
Why didn't you call Jenkins? He's the boss.
Jenkins is a dick. You know he doesn't like me.
He's your ex-father-in-law, and you're the father of his grandson. He's also kept you employed far longer than anyone else in his position would have. He feels loyal to your father. That's the only reason you weren't out on the street a long time ago.
He also financed his daughter's divorce from me.
Who can blame him? You were screwing everything you could get your hands on. Listen, Nick, I'd like to help you, but we've been down this road. I just don't believe you. I think you're in a bar somewhere, probably trying to get laid, and you're trying to dump your call responsibility on somebody else. I'm not going to risk getting sued. I'm not going to risk my job at the medical group. I'm not going to risk my medical license, and I'm not going to cover for you. So either you call Jenkins right now, or I will. Is there a patient who needs care and labor right now?
I don't know. I've gotten a few pages and two calls from Southside Birthing Center.
And you're on call there tonight?
Yeah.
What did they say?
I didn't answer.
Did they leave you a voicemail?
I haven't listened to it. Jesus, Bernie, babies practically deliver themselves. How do you think the human race got this far in the first place? The nurses can handle it.
Are you listening to yourself, Nick? What the hell's the matter with you? Whatever you're doing, stop it right now. Call Jenkins. No, I'm calling Jenkins. But you get your ass over there and see about your patient. I just hope everything is all right.
Fine, asshole, Fratora said. I'll find somebody else to cover.
I'm calling Jenkins, he heard Weinstein say as he disconnected the call. Fratora started going through his contact list of the other doctors in his group as he walked out of the bathroom. He was thinking about cocaine, Viagra, and what he was going to do to that voluptuous blonde named Danielle Davis. When he walked back into the bar, he didn't see her. He stepped to his stool and motioned the bartender over.
"Where's the blonde who was here?" he said.
"She paid and bolted as soon as you went into the bathroom," the bartender said.
"Shit,"
Fratora muttered under his breath.
"Bring me my tab."
Chapter 3. About half an hour after we arrived at the birthing center, I began to get the distinct impression that something was wrong. Fratora still hadn't shown up, and the nurse's demeanor had changed. Her face was tight. She was moving quickly. She kept checking the monitors, and she kept feeling Grace's baby bump and talking quietly to Grace. She left the room several times.
"Have you heard from the doctor?" I said to her when she walked back in after leaving for the third time.
"I'm sure he'll be here soon."
"Everything okay with Grace?"
"Of course."
She turned and gave me a strained smile.
"Everything is fine."
She ran her hands over Grace's belly again, looked at all the monitors again, and turned to me.
"Excuse me, I'll be back as soon as I can," she said.
"You just got here," I said as she hurried out the door. When she came back about 5 minutes later, she had an older woman with her, also wearing a nurse's uniform.
"Hi," the woman said to me. "I'm Allison Broyles, a registered nurse. I'm just going to take a look at a couple of things."
"What's going on?" I said. "And don't say nothing. Don't tell me everything is fine, because I can tell from the look on your face that everything isn't fine."
"Your baby's heart rate has dropped some," Nurse Broyles said. "That concerns me a little."
"Where's the doctor?"
"We called the head of his group. He's on his way."
"But where is the doctor who was supposed to be here when we got here?"
Nurse Broyles turned, looked at me, straightened her back, and said, "I don't know, sir. We've been trying to reach him, and he isn't responding."
I got up and walked over to the bedside. I took Grace's hand. "Do you feel okay?" I said.
"I feel a little strange," Grace said, "but I think I'm okay."
"No pain?"
"No, I feel a little woozy, but no pain."
"We're going to need to move you to another room,"
Nurse Broyles said. Just to be on the safe side.
What room? I said.
We're going to move her to an operating room. When the other doctor gets here, if the baby needs to be taken out quickly, we want to have her ready.
This doesn't sound good, I said.
It's just a precaution. Everything will be fine.
A couple of orderlies showed up just then, and I reached down and kissed Grace on the forehead. I love you, Grace, I said. You're going to be fine. I'll be waiting for you. See you soon.
A tear slipped from Grace's eye, and she smiled up at me. I've been waiting for months to hear those words, she said. I love you too, Darren.
She blew me a kiss, and they pushed her out of the room.
Nurse Diaz is going to accompany you to a special waiting room while we take Miss Grace to the operating room, Nurse Broyles said.
Just then, a large man walked through the door. He was wearing a brown sport coat, a white button-down shirt, and brown slacks and shoes. He was around 40 and had curly dark hair and wore wire-framed glasses. I immediately noticed bloodshot eyes behind the lenses.
Dr. Fatura, Nurse Broyles said. Nice of you to join us. Jenny, would you take Mr. Street to the waiting room?
As we started to walk out of the room past Dr. Fatura, I stopped dead in my tracks. Jenny was in front of me and Nurse Broyles was behind me. You're Dr. Fatura? I said. Where the hell have you been? Have you been drinking? I moved up close to him and pointed my finger at his nose. You smell like a distillery. Go on to wherever you were going, Fatura said. I don't have time to fool with you right now. How would you know that? I said. You just got here. You don't have any idea what's going on.
Are you a doctor?
Fatura said. I'm a lawyer and you're late, your speech is slurred and you stink of booze. I'm your worst nightmare right now, you drunk piece of shit. I turned around and looked at Nurse Broyles. Is the other doctor here yet? There's no way this drunk is touching Grace. I felt a hand on my arm. It was Nurse Jenny. I don't know whether she was trying to soothe me or restrain me, but neither was working. Nurse Broyles walked past us and out the door.
The other doctor is probably here by now, Nurse Jenny said softly. Let's go on to the other waiting room.
I asked you a minute ago where you've been, I said to Fatura. I want an answer. You've been in a bar, right? Which one? Or do you just sit at home and drink when you're on call? You're crazy, Fatura said. Get the hell out of here. Get out of my face.
Come on, Mr. Street, Jenny said. Please, there's nothing you can do here.
I pulled my arm away from Jenny and stepped to within a foot of Fatura. You're right about me being crazy, I said, lowering my voice. And if any harm comes to Grace or our baby, getting sued is going to be the least of your worries. Is that right? Fatura said, puffing up like a toad and leaning in toward me. I desperately wanted to break his jaw. I saw Jenny out of the corner of my eye as she moved to the doorway. I figured she was ready to push a panic button or call security. Fatura inched closer.
Are you threatening me? He said.
I lowered my voice even more, hoping Jenny couldn't make out what I was saying, and locked my eyes on Fatura's. I promise you this. If anything happens to Grace or the baby, I'll cut your head off with a dull knife and bury you in the mountains. Fatura took two steps back. I had his attention now. I turned back to Jenny and walked toward her. Where's that waiting room? I said, and we walked out the door. Chapter 4. The waiting room where I was taken was small and isolated. I kept thinking it was the kind of place where bad news would be delivered. I walked out several times and made my way to the nursing station. Jenny wasn't there, and neither was Nurse Broyles. The only person at the station was a 30-something brown-haired paper pusher whose dress looked like a denim tent and who wore the tired face of someone who just wanted to get the hell out of there and go sit in front of a television set and eat cookies. What's going on with Grace? I said to her each time I walked in.
I'm sorry, I don't have any news other than they're working on her.
What does that mean? I asked the third time she repeated the phrase. Working on her? Do you mean they're operating on her? Are they delivering the baby?
I really don't know, sir, she said. I'm just a record keeper.
I've been in that waiting room for a half hour, I said, my voice rising along with my anger. I want some answers. I want to know if Grace and our baby are all right. I want you to go right now and find someone who can tell me something, or I'm going to go find Grace myself.
Don't get belligerent with me, sir, she said. I'll call security and get the police here.
Good, good. Let's just have a reunion. Call security, call the police, they know me. Tell them it's Darren Street. I've been in prison before, and I'm suspected of committing several murders, although they've never been able to prove a thing. Tell them to come on down. Your choice. I couldn't believe how cavalier she was acting. I was going crazy with worry over Grace and the baby. I was being cooped up in a small waiting room with only my imagination to tell me what was going on, and what my imagination was telling me wasn't good. And then, every time I walked out to try to get some information, I was faced with this cud-chewing cow, who obviously couldn't have cared less about me or Grace or the baby or anything else except when she would eat next. Either you can call security and the police, and there'll be a hell of a scene, or you can just get off your lazy ass and go find somebody who can tell me what's going on with Grace and our daughter, I said. What's your name, anyway? I might want to catch up with you later.
What did you say? Did you just threaten me?
Did you hear me say a minute ago I'm suspected in four murders? I wasn't kidding. Go find out what's on.
Will you go back to the waiting room? She said meekly.
For 10 minutes, tops. She got up and waddled off down the hall in the opposite direction of the waiting room. I did what I told her I'd do. I went back to the waiting room and paced. I looked at my phone the second I walked in and marked the time. The countdown began. At the 7-minute mark, a man wearing gray surgical scrubs and looking tired and defeated walked in. He was my height, about 5'9", and had short, curly salt-and-pepper hair, a strong build, and a thick stubble of sideburn and beard on his face. His eyes were hazel, surrounded by pink. He appeared to be on the verge of tears. He offered his hand, and I shook it. "I'm Dr. Frank Jenkins," he said. "I'm the managing partner of the obstetrics and gynecology group that was responsible for Miss Alexander's care." "Was?" I said, and I felt my legs begin to go limp. I backed up and managed to fall into a chair before I hit the floor. I thought I noticed someone else walk in, but I couldn't really see. The world had gone gray. Shapes had become indistinguishable. "I'm so sorry. I'm going to try to explain this as simply as possible," the doctor said. He sounded as though he were in a barrel, a canyon, an echo chamber. It was a sound I'd heard only once before, the night a police officer named Bob Ridge told me my mother had been murdered. The echoes began to thicken, like he was underwater. I was able to process only bits of information. "Uterine rupture, extremely rare, separated. Torn. Baby slipped out. Abdominal cavity. Hemorrhage. Baby suffocated. Mother bled. Everything I could possibly do. Tried to save them. There just wasn't enough time. Again, so sorry." The noise that began to emanate from me came from a primal place, a place so far removed from present day that I could very well have been sitting in a cave sharpening a spear when I received the news. I cannot describe it because I did not hear it. I felt it, though later I barely remembered the feeling. It was a wail of desperation so deep and painful that the only thing I could possibly have hoped to achieve was to bring Grace and the baby back before they got too far away. "Please wait for me, Grace. I can't take any more of this pain. I'll be along soon." Chapter 5. Grace and Jasmine were flown to San Diego, where they were buried in a beautiful cemetery on a hill overlooking the Pacific. I didn't call her parents. I wasn't able at the time. But Jenny Diaz, the nurse who worked so hard to save their lives, turned out to be one of the kindest people I'd ever met. She took it upon herself to contact Grace's parents, and they made all the funeral and burial arrangements. I called Grace's mother once, 2 days after Grace died, and was told that I was not welcome at the funeral or the burial. I didn't know why she was projecting so much anger onto me, although I suppose I had caused Grace more than her share of heartache. But I wasn't responsible for her death, so I ignored what her mother said about the funeral and the burial, and I flew to San Diego. I sat in the back at the funeral, kept my mouth shut, and kept my distance at the burial. I was on a flight back to Knoxville less than 24 hours after I left. Another change had come over me, one of which I was aware, but powerless to do anything about. I was back in the same tunnel-visioned, laser-focused, emotionless state that I had entered when my mother was killed and the police told me they had a suspect. I already had my suspect. His name was Dr. Nicholas Fratura. I had to make certain of two things, though. First of all, I had to gather as much information as I could about exactly what happened in that birthing center. I remembered something about uterine rupture, so I began to research the subject. I learned it was extremely rare and could be deadly to both mother and baby. But I also learned that given prompt attention, both mother and baby had an excellent chance of survival without any long-term effects. The key was to quickly and accurately diagnose what was going on, and once the diagnosis was made, to immediately get the mother into an operating room so the baby could be removed and the doctors could stop the mother's bleeding. Typically, from everything I read, the doctors had between 10 and 30 minutes to operate once the uterus ruptured. I stared at the computer screen in my apartment and thought about that night. It had only been a week. I first knew something was wrong when Jenny Diaz, the nurse, brought the second, older nurse in to look at Grace. That was when they told me they were moving Grace to another room. If Jenny Diaz had noticed something and gone to get the second nurse, the countdown started when Jenny walked out of the room. That moment, I believed, was when Jenny Diaz began to believe Grace's uterus may have ruptured. Up to that point, the doctor was nowhere to be found. We'd been told he had been paged and that he would be arriving soon, but he didn't arrive until Grace was obviously in trouble, and when he did arrive, he looked and smelled drunk. I needed some answers, so I decided to turn to the nurse, Jenny Diaz. I called the birthing center and asked for her, but they told me she wasn't working until the next day. I asked what time her shift started, and surprisingly, the young woman I was talking to offered the information right up. Jenny would be in at 7 a.m. the next day. 12-hour shift, I said. Right? She gets off at 7? The next morning, I was in the employee parking lot at the birthing center at 6:30 a.m. At 6:45 a.m., I saw Jenny Diaz get out of a silver Chevy Malibu. I watched her walk into the hospital. I left, but I was back 12 hours later. I got out of my car when I saw her walk out of the building. It was hot, nearly 90 degrees, and muggy. I stopped about 10 feet from her car. "Excuse me, Mrs. Diaz?" She looked over at me, surprised, and then stopped dead in her tracks. "I apologize if I frightened you. I'm Darren Street. I was here last week with Grace, the woman who..." "I remember you," she said. "I wanted to thank you for your kindness."
"You're welcome," she said. "I'm sorry about what happened. I really am."
"Can we talk for a minute?"
"I really shouldn't talk to you, Mr. Street. I'm sure there will be a lawsuit."
"I'm not filing a lawsuit. Grace and I weren't married, and I don't want money for the baby. It wouldn't bring her back. Wouldn't do any good."
"Her parents will probably sue," Jenny said.
"Maybe. Probably. But that has nothing to do with why I want to talk to you." She looked around the parking lot.
"There are cameras out here."
"I know." It was a part of me now, looking for cameras everywhere I went. I was constantly vigilant about watching for people following me. I did a lot of doubling back in traffic, circling blocks multiple times, pulling in and out of parking lots. The things I'd done in the past had caused me to become paranoid.
"There's a dog park just down the street," she said. "We could talk there for a few minutes."
"Perfect. I promise I won't take much of your time. I'll follow you." I was relieved to hear that she'd talked to me, and as I followed her out of the parking lot, I wondered why a nurse, who would undoubtedly become involved in litigation, who would be deposed, and who could possibly lose her job if anyone found out she had spoken to me, would make herself so accessible. Perhaps she felt guilty. Maybe she knew instinctively that when Fratura didn't answer his pages early on, that he wasn't coming, and that she should have called the head of his medical group immediately. Perhaps she was simply a genuinely kind person and thought she could be of assistance to someone who was grieving. Or maybe she had some kind of personal grudge against Fratora. Had she known my real reason for wanting to talk to her, she probably would have fled with her arms flailing, screaming at the top of her lungs for help. But instead, 5 minutes later, we were sitting next to each other on a park bench in the shade of an elm tree while people and their dogs passed by. "Long day," I said. She looked tired, but she was a pretty woman with high cheekbones, dark, smooth skin, and shiny black hair.
"How did you know when I would be getting off?" she said.
"I called the nurse's station last night. They told me."
"No questions asked?"
"Nope."
"I guess it's a good thing you're not some kind of murderer or stalker."
"If you only knew," I thought. "Yeah," I said. "You might want to speak to them about giving out information over the phone."
"I assumed the woman who died was your girlfriend, but I wasn't sure until you said so back in the parking lot. How long had you known her?"
"Several years. We were engaged once, but we went through a rough time and broke up for a little while."
"She was a sweet lady."
"Yes. Yes, she was."
"Where is she now? I mean, I know she isn't, you know. Was her funeral here in Knoxville?"
"She was originally from San Diego. She and the baby are there now. It's a nice spot." She folded her hands and looked down at the ground.
"What did she do? For a living, I mean?"
"She was a lawyer. She worked in the federal system defending criminals."
"Really? That beautiful lady was a criminal lawyer?"
I smiled and nodded my head. "Don't let the pretty face fool you. She was as tough as a pine knot. Smart, too. The world lost a fine lawyer and an even better person."
"I'm so sorry," she said, and her eyes began to fill with tears.
"Please, I know this wasn't your fault. I've done a lot of research, and I know you did everything you could do. There are some things that I have to know, though. I'm not going to do anything rash, but if my suspicions are true, I'm going to do everything in my power to see to it that this doesn't happen to anyone else."
"You're talking about Dr. Fratora?"
I nodded. "I know you said you haven't been here long, but what can you tell me about him?"
"He has problems," Jenny said.
"What kind of problems?"
"Substance abuse, drugs and alcohol, and from everything I've heard, he's an insufferable womanizer."
"Has anything like this happened before that you know of?"
"Like what? A mother and baby dying because he was out drinking? No, I don't think anything like that has happened before. But he's been late before. He's had other doctors in his group cover for him. He's come in smelling of alcohol."
"You've witnessed all these things firsthand?"
"Just a couple of times. He came in smelling like booze 3 weeks ago and then last week with your girlfriend. But the other nurses talk about him a lot. They hate him."
"The day we were there, you said you paged him. How many times?"
"3. I paged him when I was first made aware that you were on your way to the hospital. I paged him again about 15 minutes later because I hadn't heard anything back from him. I paged him again after I got Grace into the room and the monitors hooked up. And then I called him."
"You called him? Did you talk to him?"
"No, it went to voicemail."
"Did you leave him a message?"
"I did. I told him he had a patient who was within a half hour or so of giving birth. Then I called him again when the baby's heart rate first started to drop."
"Why does he still have a medical license?" I said. "Why is he still working if he does these kinds of things? Dr. Jenkins seems like a good man. Why would he put up with it?"
"My understanding is that Dr. Jenkins keeps him on because Dr. Fratora's father was Dr. Jenkins' best friend. They started the medical group together. A few years back, Dr. Fratora's father died of pancreatic cancer, but before he died, he asked Dr. Jenkins to take care of his son. He knew his son was having problems. Dr. Fratora was also married to Dr. Jenkins' daughter, but she divorced him a couple of years ago. They have a 5-year-old boy who is severely autistic. It's complicated, to say the least. I think Dr. Jenkins is just trying to do the right thing by everyone, but Dr. Fratora keeps getting worse and worse. From what everyone is saying, there could be some real problems over what happened to your girlfriend and your daughter."
"Do you by any chance know what bars he hangs out in? Does he have a favorite that you know of?"
"I've heard a couple of nurses say you can find him at the portal 2 or 3 times a week. I've also heard them mention Spankies."
I'd heard of both bars. Spanky's was a meat market in the old city, frequented mostly by upperclassmen and graduate students at the University of Tennessee. The Portal was a high-end bar and restaurant in Turkey Creek. I looked at Jenny and reached out my hand. She took it, and I squeezed and shook her hand gently. "Thank you for talking with me," I said.
"What are you going to do, if you don't mind my asking? I probably shouldn't tell you this, but when you and Dr. Futuro were talking in Grace's room, when it got really tense, I thought I heard you threaten him."
"I don't really remember what I said to him," I lied, "but I don't think I threatened him. If I did, it was an empty threat. I'm not a violent person. I am a lawyer, though, and I think Grace and Jasmine, that was the baby's name, deserve some justice. I'm going to talk to the district attorney general and try to have Dr. Futura arrested."
"Arrested? For what?"
"Reckless homicide? Maybe criminally negligent homicide?"
"What's the difference?"
"Reckless is a little worse. I think drinking while you're on call, ignoring pages and telephone calls and messages from the hospital, and finally showing up drunk is reckless behavior, especially when a woman and a baby die because of it. I think he deserves to be punished."
"So he could go to jail?"
"I hope so," I said. "That seems like a more just outcome to me than an insurance company having to pay out a bunch of money." Just outcome, I thought. Here I was, the killer of four men, talking about just outcomes. But justice, to me, had become nothing more than a hypocrite's word. Justice was a prettied-up term for revenge. "Speaking of money, Jenny, do you happen to know what kind of car he drives? Guy like that probably drives something flashy and expensive."
"Why would you want to know what kind of car he drives?"
"I don't know. Just curious, I guess."
"It's one of the flashiest cars I've ever seen," she said. "Brand new Porsche 911 Cabriolet. I've heard him brag about it to other doctors. It's some kind of turbo something or other. He said it cost him more than $200,000.
"Wow," I said. "Have you seen it?"
"Yeah, of course. You can't miss it in the parking lot. It's silver."
I thanked Jenny again for talking with me, and she stood and said goodbye. As I watched her walk away, black hair waving in the breeze, I thought again about the chances of getting the district attorney to agree to prosecute a doctor under these circumstances. It was doable. The facts fit the law for a prosecution for reckless homicide. I knew Grace wouldn't want me to kill Dr. Futura. Her preference, I believed, would have been for me to sue him on Jasmine's behalf and let her parents sue on her behalf. But I thought she also would have gone along with the idea of filing a reckless homicide charge in criminal court. At least that's what I told myself, because I wasn't going to sue anyone. Filing a lawsuit would take years, involve dozens of depositions and court hearings. Lawyers who defended medical malpractice cases worked for medical malpractice insurance companies, and they were cutthroat litigators and strategists. Their goal was always to drag a case out, especially a big money case like Grace and Jasmine's, until the other side became so frustrated that they finally gave up and settled. They would come into court and file motions, trying to convince a judge that a cloudless sky was green if it suited their purpose. They would prolong depositions for days, harassing and intimidating witnesses, going through minutiae that had absolutely no relevance to anything, until the plaintiff's lawyer or lawyers finally threw up their hands in frustration and disgust. So I was going to try another route. I had a plan. First, I would go to the portal and ask around about the night Futura was there. I'd talk to the bartenders, the waitresses, the bouncers, anyone who would talk to me, and I'd find out what Futura had done there that night when he was supposed to be taking care of Grace. Then I would go to the district attorney, a man I knew and had helped get elected. I would give the criminal justice system another chance. I would lay out a case for him that was a lock. I would hand him Dr. Nicholas Futura's head on a platter and let him make an example out of a man who deserved far worse than a few years in jail. I would give the district attorney an opportunity to garner some excellent publicity for himself and his staff. It would be win-win. But if that system failed me, as it had in the past, I would have to take matters into my own hands. And once again, I didn't give a damn about the consequences. Chapter 6. I was a little surprised Stephen Morris agreed to see me, although we'd been close at one time. Morris was the district attorney I'd helped get elected more than 6 years earlier after I successfully freed my Uncle Tommy from prison. Morris beat Ben Clancy, my nemesis, largely because of the work I put in on Morris's campaign. It didn't really hurt Clancy, though. He immediately moved on to the U.S. Attorney's Office, where one of his old political cronies gave him a job as an assistant U.S. attorney. He later used that position to frame me for a murder and send me off to prison. I got out, with Grace's help, after 2 years. Not long after that, Clancy disappeared. I knew Morris, along with every other local and federal law enforcement officer within 50 miles, suspected that I had killed Clancy. They also thought I had killed a couple of rednecks in West Virginia who were suspected of dynamiting my mother's house. They were right, but they couldn't prove anything, and I wasn't about to offer any admissions. I tried to get Morris to meet me at a coffee shop or diner somewhere, but he insisted that I come to his office in the city-county building a couple of blocks from Neyland Stadium, where the Tennessee Volunteers had played mediocre football in front of huge crowds on Saturdays for the past 10 years. He let me stew in the lobby for half an hour before he finally had his secretary lead me through the maze of hallways to his office. It was one of those ornate ego offices. It overlooked the Tennessee River, had plush leather furniture, U.S. and Tennessee flags, a vintage set of the Tennessee Code annotated on a shelf to my left, and framed certificates and photos of Morris with politicians and judges and sheriffs everywhere. He'd even somehow managed to work a chandelier into the office decorating budget. "Nice," I said as I looked around. Morris was medium height, a stocky, powerful man whose dark brown hair was perfectly cut and parted on the side. I could easily imagine him as one of those guys in the gym at 6 in the morning, wearing a spaghetti-strap tank top and spandex shorts. When I walked into his office, though, he was wearing a sharp navy blue suit with a red tie and a white shirt. "Had to fight tooth and nail for every scrap of it," Morris said. "Some of the county commissioners would just as soon have the top law enforcement officer in the county work out of a bathroom in the basement. Bunch of damned cheapskates." He reached his hand across the desk, and I took it. "Nice to see you again, Darren," he said. "A lot of water under the bridge since the last time I laid eyes on you." I nodded. "An ocean. Nice suit, Stephen. I'm not an aficionado, but that doesn't look like it came off the rack at Sears." He smiled. "It's an Armani, actually. Treat from the wife for our anniversary last year." "Well, you wear it well." "I was so sorry to hear about your mother when that terrible thing happened," Morris said. "I should have reached out, but I just didn't know what to say. We got the TBI and the ATF involved right away, but don't apologize," I said, holding up my hand. "I barely remember anything during that time. And then our two main suspects got themselves shot to hell in West Virginia." "Yeah, I know. Did you ever look at anybody else? I mean, besides me?" "I hope you're not taking that personally, Darren. The cops just let the investigation lead them. You know how they do it. They made up their minds it was me, and when they couldn't prove it, they shelved the whole thing." "Is that why you're here? Do you want us to reopen the investigation into your mother's death?" I shook my head. "I don't think it would do any good at this point. I'm here about something else. Did you hear about Grace Alexander and my daughter?" He nodded and put his elbows on the desk. "I did, and again, I'm so sorry. I met her once, you know." "Grace?" "Yeah, she told me. She said it didn't go very well between the two of you." "She told me I didn't have any balls." I smiled. Grace had never told me she'd used those exact words, but I didn't doubt it. She was one of the kindest people I ever met, but if she got riled, she wasn't afraid to speak her mind. It wasn't always what people wanted to hear. "The worst part about it was she was right," Morris said. "She came to me and told me Clancy had framed you and she wanted me to help, but I refused. I was afraid of the big Fed machine, and then you got out and cleared yourself. That was an amazing feat. Like they say, the truth shall set you free." "What do you think happened to him?" Morris said. "Who, Clancy?" "Yeah. You think somebody killed him? I mean, none of his credit cards were ever used, and his money is still in the bank, from what I know. He isn't sitting on a beach sipping rum punch, but he hasn't been declared legally dead yet. Guys like Clancy never die, I said. They just fester. So you think he's still around somewhere? He had a lot of enemies. He did a lot of bad things. I think somebody probably got even with him. Well, I don't suppose you came here to talk about Ben Clancy, Morris said. I didn't. I came here to talk to you about Grace and our baby and what happened to them. Do you know anything about it? Just what I read in the obituary, that Grace and the baby both died during childbirth. There's a lot more to it, I said. Have you ever heard of a doctor named Nicholas Fratura? Morris twitched almost imperceptibly when I said the name. His chin came up just a touch, and his head leaned to the right. It was something a normal person might not even pick up on, but I was anything but a normal person at this point. I saw the twitch. He knew him. What was the last name? Fratura, about your age, early 40s, works for an OBGYN group here in town. Morris shook his head slowly and averted his gaze. Fratura. Can't say that I do. He was lying. I would have bet my life on it. I'd like for you to get to know him, I said. And then I'd like you to charge him with 2 counts of reckless homicide and send his sorry ass to the penitentiary where he belongs. Darren, do you have any idea how hard medical cases are to prove? That's why they all wind up as wrongful death cases in civil court. This one shouldn't be that tough, I said, and over the next several minutes, I laid out everything I knew. I told him what happened the night Grace and Jasmine died, what I'd learned at the bar, how Fratura had come in late and drunk, and how Jenkins had tried to save Grace and Jasmine. The only thing I left out was the threat I made to cut off Fratura's head and bury him in the mountains. I can see some problems with this right on the front end, Morris said. By his tone, I knew he'd already made up his mind. There would be no criminal prosecution. Really? What problems? The first thing that jumps out at me is that we'll have to prove he was intoxicated if we want to prove he was reckless. You do the same thing I did. You send investigators to the bar he was in. It's called the Portal. Like I said, I've already been there and talked to the bartender who served him that night. The bartender's name is Bud. You subpoena the tab, take a look at his credit card records, get your investigators to talk to Bud, get them to talk to the blonde he was bird-dogging. Her name is Danielle Davis. Subpoena his phone records for the pages and the calls and the voicemails that came from the birthing center. Canvas for witnesses. I'll testify that he was drunk when he came into Grace's room, and I'm sure a couple of nurses and maybe a doctor will too. Do a timeline. It should be open and shut. Okay. Let's say we do all those things. We find out he had too much to drink. We find out he ignored the pages and the phone calls you told me about. The fact remains that he didn't lay a hand on Grace, if I'm understanding you correctly. He didn't do the surgery, right? That's right, but then how do we prove he caused the deaths recklessly or otherwise if he didn't touch Grace or the baby? The whole point is that he acted recklessly by drinking and not responding to the pages when he was the doctor on call that night. When a uterine rupture occurs, the medical literature says they have between 10 and 30 minutes to get the baby out and attend to the mother. If he hadn't been drunk, he would have been there and would have been able to take care of her. Instead, he got there late and he was drunk. They had to wait for another doc to show up, and by that time, it was too late. And he hires a defense expert who comes into court, a highly paid medical whore, to testify it was something entirely different that killed Grace and the baby. They'll say the birthing center or the OBGYN group should have a backup doctor on call and immediately available. We get into a war of experts, the jury goes to sleep, and we're dead in the water. Who made the call that Fratura couldn't do the surgery? What? You mean when he finally showed up? Right. Which doctor or medical administrator gave the order that Dr. Fratura was too intoxicated to operate on Grace and the baby? I don't know. I know I told him right there in Grace's room that there was no way he was touching Grace. He was shit-faced, Stephen. He smelled like a distillery. His eyes were red and bloodshot. His speech was slurred. The guy was too drunk to be driving a car,
let alone cutting open a human being and performing surgery in a life-and-death situation. Was he stumbling? How long did you talk to him? Did you know it was a life-and-death situation at the time? I've been around enough drunks in my life to know that